Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Richard Nolan to the broadcast. Dick is the Philip M. Condit Endowed Chair in Business Administration at the University of Washington School of Business, where he is evolving a set of workable management principles for the information economy. Prior to joining the University of Washington faculty, Dick was the William Barclay Harding Professor of Management of Technology at Harvard Business School. For the past 5 years, together with Qatar fellow Rob Austin, and in conjunction with the Seattle Innovation Network of researchers, Dick has been studying sustainable innovation, most recently with a focus on company innovators who have been able to capture real value from innovative uses of computing. Dick served as chairman and CEO of Nolan Norton & Company, an information technology management consulting company, from 1977 until 1987, when the company was acquired by KPMG. After the acquisition, Dick served as chairman of Nolan Norton & Company and a partner of KPMG until 1991. Dick is the originator of the Stages Theory, one of the most widely used management frameworks for IT baselining and planning. He also has authored and co-authored a number of books, including Globalization, Technology, and Competition, Building the Information Age Organization, Structure, Control, and Information Technologies, and Dot Vertigo. Dick is also a member of the board of directors for Novell. Dick has written numerous business cases and articles, including Bridging the Gap Between Stewards and Creators in the Sloan Management Review, co-authored with Rob Austin, which won the Richard Beckhard Memorial Prize awarded to the authors of the most outstanding SMR article on plan change and organizational development. Also, his book, The Adventures of an IT Leader, co-authored with Rob Austin and Shannon O'Donnell, an account of the new CIO's first year on the job, will be published by Harvard Business School Press in the spring of 2009. I recently caught up with Dick by phone in his office in Seattle, and our conversation touched on Principle 4, IT and Business Partnerships, as we discussed IT's role in innovation, Principle 5, as we discussed Dick's experience as a consultant and as an observer of trends in outsourcing, as well as the evolution of IT throughout his career. Dick Nolan, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World-Class IT.
Well, Peter, it's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Well, Dick, over the course of your career as a business school professor, as the head of a consultancy, you've had a chance to see a lot of change in the way that major corporations around the world think about and use technology. And I wonder if you could take a moment to talk about this evolution that you've seen over the past few decades.
Sure. And, you know, Peter, let me apply the stages framework as a way of kind of thinking about that.
That's great.
And if I do that, we see IT evolving through three main eras: the DP era from 1960 to 1980, the micro era from 1980 to 1995, and now the network era, beginning around 1995 and continuing. Mm-hmm. And most important in the way that companies have approached IT, I think, is from an almost solely spectator sport to more of a participatory sport. And by this, I mean early on in the DP/mainframe era, it was pretty much left to a technical CIO. During the micro era, it started to really shift with the advent of the PC, where we saw the personal computing impact, where more and more functional areas got involved as well as functional managers. Mm-hmm. And now what we're experiencing is not only are the senior managers intimately involved in IT, but we're even seeing board level directors.
Yes.
Being involved through the form of a special IT oversight committees. Mm-hmm. So, from a company context, we've gone from a company context to a national context to a global context. And the organizational changes from rather the historical rigid, vertically integrated, highly decentralized functional hierarchy to much more of an organic, changing in size, expanding to opportunities, contracting during tough times, being very global and more of a horizontally integrated network.
That's interesting. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the drivers for each of those changes as each of those periods came to fruition. What were some of the attributes that led to the changes from each? Were there certain leaders in industries that pushed the laggards to follow them? Obviously, 1995, around the time that Netscape went public, and not necessarily the advent of the internet, but the explosion of the internet, which led to a lot of the networking. But can you talk a little bit about those transition periods and what led business leaders to embrace the sorts of changes, since naturally they needed to be part of the decision process to make this sort of happen?
Well, I think that the main driver, when we strip things away, has been this incessant movement of and improvements in information technology that we've observed as we've moved and transitioned from the industrial economy and the structures that were appropriate in those environments, where information technology was not really well developed, to the point where now it has emerged to the point where it's literally ubiquitous in the organization and has become a global enabler.
Yes.
So if you kind of look at it that way, you can almost draw a normal curve, for each one of those eras, the DP era, PC era, and now the network era, and identify early adopters.
Yes.
in each one of those.
And were the early adopters, how much did they benefit from being on the leading edge versus those who followed or adopted quickly thereafter?
That's a fascinating question. Clearly, you can see some that have been able to sustain their first mover advantages. But what we've also learned is that the another aspect of the information technology and the networks and Googling and all that makes almost instant communication. Fast follower continues to close very, very rapidly, changing the nature and the economics of the early adopters' advantages.
Yes.
So you look at, American Airlines clearly is cited in the the early adopter, Citibank in the DP mainframe era.
Yes.
Now what we see is clearly that's dissipated. The reservations have become a commodity over the internet. When we look at the micro era, Frito-Lay comes to mind as an early adopter, and with their handhelds out there.
Yes.
They've continued to gain advantages from that, but not at the level as their competitors closed.
Yes.
And now we're seeing, we're kind of seeing some very interesting aspects in the network here. I mentioned earlier in our discussions about Boeing with their 787 product-driven innovation. And what is different there is just the time and the learning that has gone on over the three eras, and culmination into a situation where Boeing is using the network technologies literally all through their current business transformation. You're seeing them build a real-time integrated supply chain with visibility through their strategic partners.
Yes.
You're seeing the technology impacting the plane, where a lot of the value-added propositions have to do with customer airline services that they're providing. And organizationally, the company has moved from this vertically integrated structure where they were, so to speak, building stick airplanes where the assembly was done in the factory itself, and most of the parts came from vertically integrated units,
yes.
Mostly around Seattle. Today, that plane is being built globally, tapping into a global workforce. The research and development on the major components has to some extent been decentralized, and it's impacted the entire organizational structure, whereby this company is now not a vertically integrated company. They've been selling off their plants and
yes.
to partners, and you know, it's built of a networked IT-enabled global structure.
Yes. Very interesting, and I think it's fascinating, especially to think of a manufacturing firm who has traditionally an area that sometimes, at least among some areas of manufacturing, which tend to be at times laggards from a technology perspective, really embracing and going to the forefront and using technology in such a creative way. It's amazing to think about that transformation as you describe that.
Well, and it's a very interesting one to focus on a company like Boeing, which I would describe as a early high-tech company.
Mm-hmm.
And the nature of their product, the thing is flying 5 miles up in the air, close to the speed of sound.
Yes.
Boeing people describe this as 1.5 million parts flying in close formation. You have millimeters of aluminum or the plane's skin that separate the passengers from this very hostile environment.
Right.
That if it was breached, you have about 15 seconds to live before suffocate or freeze to death.
Right.
So there's no cheating in this.
Yeah, exactly.
It has to be perfect.
Great point.
And so it's a very interesting high tech product. And when you contrast that with the dot-com companies, which for a while we were focusing on as new leading-edge kinds of organizational structures that
yes.
were IT-enabled, and then the financial services community, we're getting fewer and fewer exemplars that we can focus on, but I think Boeing stands out as one that that really is an exemplar that we can learn a lot from.
Yes. Very interesting. Well, I know that Boeing is one of a lot of companies that you've met with some frequency as part of your Seattle Innovation Symposium. And I wonder if you can take a moment to reflect upon the several years now that you've been leading the efforts to gather people in Seattle and talk about innovation, especially as it relates to technology, and perhaps speak to some of the trends that you see emerging across the various companies and industries that you've learned about as part of those symposiums.
Sure. We've been now conducting the Seattle Innovation Symposium research series since 2005 with an annual get-together of a multidisciplinary, actually worldwide group of researchers that include business types, computer science types, legal types, those that are interested in the role that innovation is playing, and more specifically, IT-enabled innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And the initial question that we addressed was, why does it take so long for emerging technologies to be translated into environments, that is, businesses or ventures for creating business value?
Mm-hmm.
I think we've been making good progress on this issue, and with the enabling IT environment continuing to expand in magnitude and diversity, we're honing in on the importance of top management leadership in this participatory IT strategy and management.
Yes.
And the importance of moving from make and sell strategies, characteristic of the industrial economy, into these IT-enabled sense and response strategies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you know, it's very interesting to come back, circle back to what you were asking about before. What are the drivers
yes.
for being able to you know, to create these businesses that are actually able to extract strategic value from the IT opportunities? And we see, you know, two things that are really important. And one I already mentioned, which is the top management leadership kind of creating these organizational cultures which focus on not just innovation, but sustained, rapid innovation.
Yeah. Do you see innovation, obviously, is a very interesting topic, industry by industry, company by company, and there are some organizations that think of innovation as a multidisciplinary part of the organization, bringing together people from the product areas, people from technology, people from various aspects of the business. There seems to be a trend now among some companies having innovation sit within the IT department itself, certainly, of course, still drawing upon those very same areas. But I wonder if you've seen similar trends. I think about Tim Stanley, for example, at Harrah's Entertainment, who was a longtime chief information officer and fairly recently took on the role as the chief innovation officer and a different kind of CIO for his organization, drawing a lot from various aspects of the business, but certainly putting him in charge because of his creative use and, in fact, innovative use of information technology within that organization. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how you've seen the role of innovation, specifically the actual innovation organization within different companies, how that has evolved.
It's a very, very interesting question. I think when you strip things away, we're talking about sustained innovation mostly because of the new opportunities that exist from IT.
Yes.
So it is natural for the IT and the CIO to take a leadership role mm-hmm. on innovation.
Yes.
And it is interesting in the you know, in the Harrah example, where Stanley actually, you know, is moved out of the IT into a general, it sounds like a general management role for innovation. And this seems to me to be a natural course of making the ubiquitous IT that's already out there, what I call a participatory sport for the management team,
yes.
rather than expecting them to be not intimately involved and more spectator-like, if you will.
Yes.
So I think this is a trend. I think that, again, as we strip it away, the opportunities typically surround the technology, the being able to exploit those opportunities, however, is also just as important, or even more important perhaps, than the technology, because it does involve understanding the competitive strategy of the organization, its industry, its culture, its ability to change,
yes.
All those factors that take a long time, take a lot of effort, and are need to be tailored into each organization. There's not, you know, just a general template that you can apply.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great points. It's interesting to think about that. I mean, in some ways, especially as it relates to IT and the IT executive, it also suggests perhaps a new way of thinking about the sorts of skills that person, that executive, needs to bring to the table, and perhaps may even play a part in allowing or demanding, in fact, businesses to think about different kinds of IT leaders, so that they actually are intellectually nimble enough not only to know the zeros and ones, but also to think about innovation within a business context.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. In fact, we're seeing just an acceleration of the trend of taking your high-flying operating managers, fast-tracked operating managers, and moving them through the CIO position, and then, you know, back into the overall organization to create just what you've described.
That's very interesting. Very interesting indeed. We've also recently done a study about the number of CEOs who, at one point or another in their organization, John Bausch is another example, actually another former CIO at Harrah's Entertainment who became CEO of Ameristar, Bruce Parker, who was a participant, like John, a participant in the Forum on World Class IT, who spent time as CIO at Ryder and United Airlines and eventually became the CEO of a company called AirNet. And seeing that set of skills that the CIO gains as being really a great launching pad, perhaps paradoxically, at least in the normal way of thinking about things, that the IT role, in fact, is one that is incredibly valuable, a certain number of skills that are learned there that can be applied in much bigger roles within the organization.
Indeed, we used to, when I first started in the industry, the only one we felt that was going to happen, Peter. The only one though we could point to early on was George Rockwell, who became CEO of State Street Bank and had a wonderful run.
Yes.
But it's now becoming much more commonplace.
Exactly, it's good to see that happening. Well, I wonder, actually, Dick, you have a very interesting career as academics go. You spent some time as a business professor and then took some time away to found your own consulting firm, Nolan Norton, which you operated for, if I recall correctly, a little more than a decade, and then sold it to KPMG, spent a little more time, and then returned to academics. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that experience as someone who has sat on both sides of the table, has been a professor and a studier of business, but also has gotten very much into the game of advising businesses as they have thought about their IT needs.
I'd be pleased to. I'd start out by saying I've been really blessed to stumble into the IT field early in my PhD studies, and then was fortunate growing up in Seattle to work for the then leading and still leading company in the use of IT, which has been Boeing. And I've always felt that the back and forth with academic study and industry work experience was important in understanding the path and impact of IT in the world.
Yes.
It's also these experiences that led me to formulate the stages theory as a descriptive theory in contrast to a predictive theory. And, you know, using a descriptive theory that one could then build also a taxonomy for observing IT in companies.
I see.
So based upon that that academic work, we went on to introduce some, I think, really important management ideas. For example, one of the early aspects of the stages theory was to introduce the idea of the applications portfolio of a company to break applications away from the specific use of technology. And this concept allowed us to get a real view on what on overlaying what IT was actually doing to improve business operations or the implementation of the of the strategy.
Yes.
So the power of the stages theory being descriptive rather than predictive has allowed its expansion into describing the major technology eras, which I just described as the DP era, micro era, and the network era.
Yes.
And clearly the current network era is evolving within the legacy of the early eras, which is important to understand. This is what a lot of companies are struggling with in terms of their legacy systems, for example.
Yes, yeah, good point.
And, you know, so this allows us to understand the context of how IT evolves in organizations and the importance of the individual experiential learning that transpires in organization. So this has been, something that has been a product of being able to move back and forth between the academic and immersion in companies that are effectively trying to utilize the technology. And, you know, that's kind of given me a a set of lenses that has been, I think, very useful for trying to share some of the observations using that approach.
That's great. That's very great. Very good. And obviously, even as you've returned to academics, you've still spent a lot of time working with businesses, consulting businesses. And so it seems as though your time as a consultant still very much powers the way that you think and the way that you act today.
Oh, absolutely. And then also, as we've seen information technology broaden, as we've discussed in the network era, I've been able to fortunately add work on boards of directors of some major companies to kind of gain the perspective on this whole notion of oversight on strategy and execution and the role that IT plays in all that.
Yes. And I wonder, actually, lingering on that point a moment, as you've been speaking, it sounds like as much with business people as you have been with IT executives. You've talked about the very eloquently about the stages theory, and I wonder if you can talk about how you've seen business people evolve in terms of their understanding of IT. I think that traditionally there's been this divide in terms of differences in education, differences in the language used, differences just in terms of the general frameworks that are applied from IT into the business. And obviously, there's been a lot of change, and change for the better, the degree to which businesses understand the use of IT. But I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how you've seen that evolve as well, as businesses have come to embrace IT as opposed to seeing them as sort of the support organization, or perhaps at best an organization that can help the organization drive efficiency, but rather an organization that can drive true value for the company.
Indeed. You know, this is a subject, Peter, that we've recently, in the last year, in the Seattle Innovation Symposium 2008, we focused on, and we particularly focused on the emergence of the digital natives in light of the senior management team being these digital immigrants that haven't actually grown up and achieved a level of comfortability and proficiency with information technology, which is our a lot of our senior management in modern business. And the it's a very, very interesting tension in the organization, because obviously the senior management team has a significant amount of power in their positions, and what we've observed is that these are extremely competent people. They've gotten to those positions. They've earned their way up there. They're very smart. They're very competent.
Yes.
But there's this tension that exists with their just not having a natural feel for the nature of the technology, the vocabulary, the key concepts, and a lot of it has kind of gone with taking it for granted as the digital natives do. So there's this tension.
Yes.
And I think that the problem is getting resolved over time, but it's slow, so it still exists. I think this is a huge issue, how we incorporate effectively the digital natives and the way that they work in organizations that are very different than the industrial age organizations that many of the senior management have grown up in. Mm-hmm. And then trying to figure out mechanisms in the organization to facilitate the working together and trust that that needs to exist.
Yes.
This is how I got into from my board vantage point a number of years ago. We addressed this issue in the Harvard Business Review in an article that I did with Warren McFarlane on the role of the board in IT oversight. And yes. In that article, our major conclusion is that the board level IT oversight committee is a very powerful function for helping to address this. And one of the important ideas coming out of that is to have the organization, the company, go outside and find what's equivalent to the CFO expert, that financial expert, that certified financial expert that sits on audit committees today.
Yes.
And get someone who's had, you know, a significant IT experience from application area or from, you know, a CIO type of experience, if you will, but yes. also has the CEO perspective. And by bringing that kind of person onto the board and working on a IT oversight committee, you can have these discussions at levels, at a peer level, that often don't exist in organizations. So this is a huge issue. It's one that's getting better, but we can't really wait for all the senior managers to retire and the digital digital natives to, you know, take on those responsibilities
exactly.
to deal with it.
And as I hear you answer that question, Dick, it also occurs to me that your earlier suggestion that creative companies are now finding opportunities for skilled managers to take on at least a period of time taking on a role within IT as leaders, that perhaps that's part of the shift that will happen, part of the dynamic that will have people spending time on both sides of that traditional divide and embodying the essence of building those bridges between the two organizations.
Yes.
Very, very interesting. I wanted to just cover one last topic with you, Dick, if I may. You, for a long time now, at least 13 or 14 years, you have been writing about IT outsourcing. I'm thinking about an article that you wrote with Warren McFarlane, How to Manage an IT Outsourcing Alliance, back in 1995. And obviously, this is, since the time of that article's publication, has only become a bigger weapon in the arsenal of the IT organization and the company, more generally speaking. And I wonder if over the course of the time that you've been evaluating that, if you've seen any sort of trends emerge from that in terms of the best use of outsourced vendors or external partners for the organization.
Well, I think that the you know, what's going on in IT outsourcing broadly is really rewriting the books on IT outsourcing. And you know, as I look at this, Peter, as we see signs of Microsoft experiencing a similar experience as IBM did with you know, their dominant Windows PC platform,
yes.
and the emergence of the global network through the innovations of Google and Amazon, and Microsoft is getting in this really deeply now.
Yes.
It looks like we're shortly going to realize the vision of the IT infrastructure becoming a universally available commodity like electric power. And, you know, the innovations are now materializing pretty fast through initiatives like cloud computing. Once these associated technologies reach some level of maturity, I think we'll see this concept of being able to buy commodity-like infrastructures at price points that we haven't seen in the you know, in the global computing community.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, predictions are always hard, but while the complexity of this phenomena of cloud computing and infrastructure as a commodity is getting more and more complex, and it reminds me of the field of, you know, artificial intelligence. You know, in artificial intelligence, there's been a lot of progress, but because it got more and more complex, the progress we saw, you know, as we just looked at the overall phenomena, seemed like it ground to a halt. But in contrast, I think that what we're now seeing out there, which is, you know, the buzzword cloud computing, I think it may end up being a disruptive technology.
Yes.
And I don't see us getting bogged down like artificial intelligence.
I see. Well, very interesting. Well, Dick, I thank you so much for participating in the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a great pleasure speaking with you and tapping your great treasure trove of knowledge and stories around IT.
It's always a pleasure to share ideas with you, Peter. Thank you very much.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World Class IT. This forum has been created so that we might have a series of discussions with a variety of IT leaders to understand, evaluate, and define world-class performance as it relates to MetaStrategies' five principles of world-class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it's nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in a reactive mode, constantly fighting fires. If systems and hardware work reliably, on the other hand, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It's important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and quality assurance, through to support and all other aspects of the IT department, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming crucial to corporations, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metisstrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metisstrategy.com. Our sound editor is Christian Dooley. Our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.